Welcome aboard. It's episode 52 of the J.R. Heft Show, and we are shouting along the James with Norm Leahy. Norman, how are you,
yes, sir?
All right.
Good as I can be. I think I'm growing moss now. It's rained so much.
So you're not a rolling stone?
Are you kidding? I'm too fat to roll.
Oh, come on, man. I've seen you. You're a lean, mean fighting machine. Don't sell yourself short.
I'm just big boned, but yeah, actually, I feel dirty with all the Kavanaugh stuff.
Oh, did you watch it?
I watched bits and pieces of it as much as I could stomach, and I remember the Clarence Thomas hearings long, long time ago. I remember those things, and I thought that was a horror show then. Those hearings ain't got nothing on what happened Thursday. It was just a freak show from beginning to end. And I don't know how it ends. I don't know who wins. Mm-hmm. But I think that the smartest take that I've seen on this whole thing is that regardless of who wins, they're going to regret it.
Yeah.
But it doesn't matter. If Kavanaugh gets approved, fine. He's going to regret it. Republicans will regret it. If Democrats win and he's defeated, they're going to regret it too. Nobody wins in this. Everybody's lost. Everybody needs to hit the shower because we're all filthy because of it.
The toxicity that is involved in our politics and just with everything that's going on in general has been really troubling. And, you know, honestly, I'm okay with the Me Too movement. I think what happened with Bill Cosby this week, bringing a sexual predator down or to justice, all of these institutions, right? In the 1960s, we had these institutions that the church, government, all these things that were held in high regard, they just started to get torn down in the 1960s and the 1970s, maybe had a little bit of a pause in the 80s and 90s. And now, again, we're just taking things and progressing. And so I don't have a problem. Honestly, I don't. If we are going to shine light on bad behavior as teenagers and say, no, you as a teenage boy, you can't take advantage of a teenage girl. It's bad. It's wrong. And it's going to come back to haunt you 40 years later. Fine. That's fine. Particularly if it's truthful and it's honest, because there isn't, as a 17-year-old, you shouldn't behave that way.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not convinced that it's not a political maneuver. That's my problem.
Well, that overhangs this whole thing. I come at it that if everything everybody or anybody did as a teenager now is fair game to bring them down to middle age, nobody's safe. I don't care who you are.
Mm-hmm.
You're everybody. And I think that was the point of Lindsey Graham's outburst today, was where he basically threatened his Democratic colleagues that you better watch out for when your people come up, because it's going to be ugly. And it will be. And that's unfortunate. Is it inevitable? Yeah. I saw another take. I can't remember where I saw it exactly. But that roughly since 2000, since the coin flip that decided the presidency that year, mm-hmm. we've sort of been losing our slowly and then very quickly losing our collective political minds.
Mm-hmm.
I need to think about that some more, but I tend in first blush to give that a lot of credence. Things really, even you could even antedate that much earlier, pick a place. Some would pick the Clinton impeachment. Some would pick Iran-Contra. Some would pick Watergate. Pick your poison.
Mm-hmm.
But we have been sliding down a hill, and it seems to be accelerating. And the thing is, I don't think there's a bottom to this hill.
Yeah, well, that's why I point to the 1960s. You might even be able to go back to the JFK assassination and say, boom, that's where it happened. I can make an argument for the major cultural shifts that the seismic shifts that happened there, and then the rise of Goldwater, right? And that sort of sense of what conservatism should be, that borne out Reagan. I mean, we can go on and on. I can I can weave this thread back if we wanted to. But what we were talking about in the long podcast with Stephen Farnsworth is he began to notice a lot of this with the Perot movement and kind of this underlying angst that was associated with him that he gave voice to. And he said it went away momentarily because of the economic boom years during the Clinton administration. And then it came back post-war, okay? So post-early war with Bush. Once you got your Cindy Sheehans of the world out there starting pointing her fingers and the anti-war movement grew more and more, that's when, again, that dissatisfaction that started to have a voice, 19% of the country voting for Perot, started to come back in the form of, you know, that it certainly came back in droves with the Tea Party movement and the Affordable Care Act under Obama. It's just it's an interesting philosophical discussion to have as to kind of look back historically at what America is. But there seems, since the 1960s, there has just been this disaffected element. Some people might want to call it the independence, or some people just might, you know, I've heard the term trying to describe me, right? The angry white guy, right? I don't know. I think that there's a sense in the country that there's a good portion of people that are losing their minds and they're just angry. And it could be, you could point to the left too. You know, there's people on the left who are just throwing up their hands and saying that they're ticked off. People on the right, whether they're establishment per se, who are, you know, throwing up their hands or frustrated. And then there's this 30% base for Donald Trump that goes nowhere. He can do no wrong. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing that I'm probably, I won't say I'm worried about it, but I will say that it's something that needs to be very, very much considered, because if you are conservative, it likely means you're probably going to be on the losing side of history for a very long time.
Well, I contend that conservatism, at least professional conservatism, has been dead for about a decade, and its shambling corpse is only about collecting checks right now and not really doing anything. I see this in the output of a lot of think tanks, especially those who once upon a time seemed to have cutting edge ideas now seem to be recycling what was cutting edge in 1985. And if 1985 ever comes back, by God, they've got all the answers for all the problems that arose then, but they don't. So I think there's, it's not as much, anger is definitely a portion of the problem. So is stagnation. Intellectual stagnation. And that's even less healthy than anger. At least in anger, you're getting it out. Stagnation, you're sinking deep.
Well, you look at this conversation between Tim Kaine and Corey Stewart yesterday, or earlier this week, depending upon when you're listening to this podcast. And at least I didn't watch the debate. I'm sure you didn't either, Norm. And so that makes us talking about this probably, you know, maybe our credibility gets dinged a little bit. But when you see poll after poll coming out of Stewart trailing by nearly 20 points, and the president's approval rating at around 37% in Virginia, his disapproval rating above 50.
Yeah.
You know, you're like, okay, not really certain that, you know, the Senate race is going to be where it's at, you know. But that being said, what the rhetoric coming out of the Stewart campaign is that, all right, Tim Kaine, you know, you want to go down this path regarding, you know, holding Kavanaugh, you know, out over the pit there. Well, let's talk about all the sexual predators who are in the U.S. Senate and how much hush money has been, you know, paid on their behalf in order to keep people quiet. Stewart's trying to get attention, and he's got ours, right? Take that out of the equation. Does he have a point?
No. Go. Maybe he should go ask Al Franken how that worked for him. maybe he should ask, what's the guy in Detroit? John Conyers, mm-hmm. how that worked out for him. There was the guy from Oregon years ago, the Republican out there.
Well, this would mean Stewart does have a point because both Conyers and Franken lost.
No, they resigned. they were basically chased from office.
Right. That's my – I guess I'm being inarticulate. My point is that by exposing those guys, they no longer hold political office. And that's all Stewart is trying to say is that, you know, you paid all this hush money. You've got all these people in the U.S. Senate who are sexual predators. They need to be exposed. We need names.
Well, if he says there's hush money being paid, then – that assumes he has evidence and he needs to provide it instead of making a blanket accusation. The only one that I think that immediately comes to mind who paid any sort of money to keep people quiet was a Texas Republican, Fairnault. And he was chased from office too. So that's Mr. Stewart doesn't want to kick that rock because it is a bipartisan stew of ugly. Yep. And no, Tim Kaine is not keeping it quiet. Tim Kaine doesn't carry that kind of lumber in the Senate. And quite honestly, I know some other stories from back in the day of people who were held up in high esteem who were also old lechers and managed to shuffle off nicely into retirement. So he doesn't, Stewart, unless he's got proof, you know, put up or shut up. Don't make an accusation you can't back up.
So I'm getting ready to post my column for this week, and it's a little bit of an extension on what we just talked about regarding the polling that Stephen Farnsworth found and the conversation that I had with him, but also the conversation that I had with Alice Cassens last week. And this is just a real weird environment in the sense that we have incredible economic numbers. 17 quarters of growth, the best growth that we had last quarter since 2014, early 2014. Unemployment well lower than it was before the Great Recession. Actual job participation and employment numbers greater than when we were at the Great Recession. Consumer sentiment, for the most part, better than it's ever been, except for how you view it if you're a partisan. Republicans are sky high. Democrats are high, but not great. They're like at 75. So it's not going to be the economy. Voters are not going to go and turn out based on the economy. It is based upon this caustic nature. And if you're with Trump, great. Okay, your 37% are going to show up. But everybody else, they're really not with you. And I think that leads to the subject of your column in the Washington Post regarding what's happening in the 7th District. It's pretty fascinating.
Well, it is fascinating because it's a district that's drawn to elect a Republican. And the current incumbent, Dave Brat, is in the race of his life. New poll, Monmouth University, shows that the race is basically tied at 47%. And as you know, if you're an incumbent and you're polling below 50%, you have a problem. If you're polling below 50% at the end of September before the election, you have a big problem. And there was a super PAC poll, I think it was End Citizens United, they're backing Abigail Spanberger, the challenger. They showed the same results, tied at 47%. Now, granted, there's a fair number of people who are undecided, but I asked Dan Palazzolo at the University of Richmond, he's been a source for other stories I've written in the past about these numbers. And he pulled out a couple of things that I thought were rather interesting. And one of them was the favorability ratings. In the Monmouth poll, 43% of the voters had a favorable opinion of Abigail Spanberger, 35% of Brat. That's interesting. Hmm. More interesting is that people actually had an opinion of the challenger. Usually they don't know who the challenger is, especially when you have an incumbent running for re-election. But Only 39% had no opinion on Spanberger. Brad had 37%. So for an incumbent, 37% of the people have no opinion about you. That means you're probably a ghost, and they don't know. They couldn't pick you out of a police lineup. But the other thing that he picked up was that Spanberger has consolidated the Democrats behind her overwhelmingly, and Brat is still working on that. There are, in this poll, a fair number of Republicans who are going to vote for Spanberger. That's a problem. And that's a problem that Republicans have had in recent years in Virginia. And, you know, in this, I also asked whether the Kavanaugh follies were going to have any effect on the outcome of this race. It's a House race, so it's a little tangential, obviously, because a House member can't vote on a Supreme Court nominee. But he said all of this stuff is already pretty much baked into the numbers. Mm-hmm. This is an extension of the anti-Trump vote. They're already energized. This doesn't really – you can't overamp them any more than they already are. But what it does show, he says, all this number shows is that there is – already, even if you don't have the Kavanaugh thing, there was already an unprecedented level of support for a Democrat in this district, which is true. And I don't know how it ends. Mr. Brad, I think, still has would be the very slight favorite only because of the geography and makeup of the district. But if Spanberger is able to roll up the votes in the Richmond media market in the interior suburbs, she's got a shot.
So when Democrats win a couple seats here congressionally, and then they control perhaps the General Assembly in 2020, we want nonpartisan redistricting, right?
Well,
they're gonna still be all for it, right?
that's always been a stick to beat the other side with. I don't necessarily believe there's such a creature as a nonpartisan redistricting, because unless it's run by artificial intelligence, it's run by people who have biases, no matter how much they try to cover them up.
Yeah, so I wanted to say from the Mary Washington poll where they surveyed in the Senate campaign, you see something very similar regarding those who are supportive of Tim Kaine. Now, he's the incumbent, right? Okay, so he's had name and recognition. The man ran for vice president, for crying out loud. So I would expect his numbers to be this way. But he has already locked in 90% of the Democratic vote. If anything, you could say, really, only 90?
yeah.
But at the same time, you look at where Corey Stewart is in terms of how he's managed to lock up the Republican side. It's only at 73. And so, you know, that ain't good for the Republican heading into this race either. That's why we're seeing 19 points. Will we see those numbers come closer? I do not see Stewart losing by double digits in Virginia. I just don't see that kind of blowout. And a lot of it is going to be on turnout motive models and motivation. You know, so how much is Trump going to continue to piss off the electorate over the next month?
Here's the thing. There is precedent for a candidate to lose by double digits in the Senate race. Jim Gilmore managed to do it to Mark Warner in 2008. And I think there was an even bigger one a few years. I think it was in the 1980s. Somebody got swamped there, too, in one of Chuck Robb's races. So I would not dismiss the idea that Mr. Stewart could lose by double digits. If he does lose by double digits, he drags down other portions of the ticket with him.
Mm-hmm.
And quite honestly, maybe they need to go. Maybe this is what breaks the fever. I kind of doubt it. Democrats, some of the Democrats running are just as goofy as the day is long. And I don't agree with much of what they stand for. But I don't agree with much of what the Republicans stand for either. In fact, maybe we could all just send them on a long cruise somewhere and have them duke it out in a Thunderdome.
You know, maybe, and maybe to a certain extent, our mood, your and my mood, is kind of what's driving. We're being reactionary, or I am. You know, I'm being reactive to what I'm seeing out there, and it, you know, I don't like it. It kind of puts me in the dumps. What we really need is a dose of optimism. We need people talking positively. We need people talking about, you know, the good that's happening every day by human beings throughout the Commonwealth of Virginia. The fact that our economy is strong and that that's in spite of maybe what the government is doing and not because of what the government is doing. And yeah. So, you know, we need people talking like that. And that's going to restore a little bit of confidence in the political system. But, you know, the sideshows that we see daily coming out of Washington, D.C., and then what ends up percolating down here in Virginia, it does depress people. And that's not the optimism we need to have that restored faith in our government.
Well, I've never been one to put much faith in governments to achieve anything. I put faith in people more than governments. And I actually think it's good when people hold their government in a degree of contempt, because it means they're apt to ask less of it. The more they ask it to do, the more it does, the more it costs, and the more people forget to do things for themselves. Not to mention government doesn't manage to do things very well.
Well, I'm good with that, as long as the person who's saying it says it with a positive, happy tone. You know, I mean, like, hey, I'm going to allow you to keep more of your money so that you can go out there and you can start your own business. And good on you, because I have faith and confidence in you in order to live the American dream. You know, yeah. I mean, talk like that instead of, you know.
Yeah, I understand exactly where you're coming from. And yes, that kind of optimistic tone, regrettably, doesn't seem to have many buyers right now.
Yeah, sure doesn't. All right, Norm, let's go ahead and say goodbye to our friends. It's just been kind of one of those weeks. I mean, it's dark and gloomy outside. I think that's part of our mood. That doesn't help. But anyway, you can find Norm at Norm_Leahy on Twitter, and also his columns on The Washington Post. I'm at J.R. Heft on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And you can always find everything here, jrheft.com. Norman, have a great weekend.
You too, sir.